you're here, you sat with Steve before, I know a little bit about him, or you seen the promotion material we put out about him, but he's an individual who, you know, really has a world-class Dharma coach. But, you know, he started at the Insight Meditation Society back in Durham, Massachusetts. Before it was even Buck. Yeah, before. Yeah. So he's part of this, you know, this original group that really brought our version of the Western Dharma to the United States. We taught the 90-day rain retreat at IMS that we've been going on for 3 years. With a monk in Burma under the legendary Upandita, now has a teaching career that spans all over the United States and Europe and New Zealand. Has been responsible for building many, I think hundreds now of schools in Burma. And all of us, fantastic, I think, some world-class teacher, and if you weren't planning on it, you should plan on going to one day retreat Saturday, but there are teachers, and there are teachers. I think Steve falls into the second category, and I think that there are a group of teachers and senior students of our generation, my generation, who realize that it's the job of this generation of teachers and senior students to really put some roots in the ground so that this practice really continues in the future generations. And so you can see that in his work, he and the co-director of the Hassan Wet Foundation have built this gorgeous hermitage in upcountry Maui. And they've been working on it for 20 years, and I was fortunate to be there when it was just two little valleys, basically with jungles in it. You know, if you saw that, it was like, what are these people doing? How could anybody take this on? I mean, it's just extraordinary job. And 20 years later, there is this gorgeous long-term practice place. It's the only thing like it in the United States where people can go and practice on a long-term basis and get guidance in individual kutis. And it involves, I think, something I remember Steve ordering and bringing in poetries. 200 or 412 poetry or something now.
364.
Finding them all over. And so when you you drop.
But now I've added another 2,000 pieces of
poetry.
No, I just poetry. So
it's not only, you know, to be clear about this, it's not like Steve and Kamala have like directed a bunch of people to do this. They've been doing it themselves. I mean, it's hands-on work, and you know, the cookies that are placed in amongst what is now basically a forest. Steve has primarily built all of them himself physically. So there's this kind of upper plateau, and when you walk down through all of these streets and everything, and you turn a corner, and there's the Dharma Hall. And you don't even see it until you're probably 40 feet from it. That's just phenomenal. So people will be practicing there for many years after everyone in this room is no longer living. And he and Kamala commissioned the translation of this work of Mahasi Sayadaw, who is really responsible in many ways for the current form of our practice. And this text of meditation instruction had never been translated into English. So, you know, like another just an enormous contribution to the Dharma and to our particular form of Theravada and the Vipassana practice that, you know, we carry on for generations. And then the last thing I'd like to mention about this planting seeds is what he's done with us and a number of sanghas around the country. And before, when there was an idea about sacramental insight meditation, we had to get a sign on for people to support us and sponsor us in order to go into a training program to go through a whole series of things that we can do. So those discussions started just about the time that they started work on the Vipassana Method Foundation hermitages almost 20 years ago. And it was Steve, Howell Masters, and John Grouse. And so for that entire time period, you know, Steve behind the scenes and sometimes in front of the scenes has been working with us and supporting us. When he comes here, he does tonight and does a one-day retreat, and we're very, very fortunate that he's going to do our residential retreat this year, which is going to be up in a forest. I think it's going to really be nice. It's a little more rustic than the kind of the upper class Dharma that we're used to practicing now, but you know, the center in Santa Rosa burned down, so we can't go there. So, but I think it's going to be great because it actually is in the middle of the forest. We will have the entire retreat grounds for ourselves, so I think it's going to be really conducive to contemplative atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, you know, we'll have a session, a half day session, where Steve will work with our leadership team. Kind of look at what we're doing, how we're doing it, what our hopes are, what our fears are, our challenges, and work with us in the work that he's done with sanghas all over the country. So once again, you know, our hope is that you know, this will be for long after all of us. So I know that I deeply am happy and dedicated to see in so many ways. Both personally and in personal practice, and then in regard to trying to create with other people and maintain the sangha. I know that our sangha is deeply indebted. So it's great to be here again. Thank you very much, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you for your invitation. I recognize many of you. Because, you know, we're all getting older, even the young folks. But they're going to pick up a lot more time growing into this. And, you know, some of us are on our way out. Not by choice. So, as Dennis mentioned, if we do it right, if we, this generation, do it right, then there will be another generation, subsequent generations that will step into the role or find what we found of value here in the Dharma. And once you find the Dharma, or once you get a connection with the Dharma, it's like the Dharma has got you. It's like you've swallowed the hook. And you may forget the Dharma, but the Dharma won't forget you. You know, it keeps pulling you back. So we should try to pass on what we've learned and the value of what we've learned. And if anybody takes it on and sees for themselves the taste of the Dharma, as the Buddha said, the taste of the Dharma is the most delightful taste. It's the taste of freedom. So if you get that, then you want more. Freedom. So, you know, when we start this kind of meditation like we were doing tonight, when we start with mindfulness and we're trying to steady our mind, we're trying to watch our mind and trying to understand what's going on in our mind and let go of the habits of mind and try to gain some stability of mind and maybe some insight, I don't know, hopefully. It's not complicated. You know, it's not difficult to understand, you know, when I say, remember to recognize the present moment's experience. My granddaughters could remember that. They knew what that meant when they were 4 years old. But it's not easy to do. Very difficult to do. Because we have these habits. These habits of mind of worry, anxiety, frustration, disappointment, self-judgment, self-condemnation, you know, distraction, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you notice that, right? Hello, you know, like, not only me, right? I know, right. Okay, so they get in the way, don't they? You know, because we have these habits of worry and anxiety, panic and depression and stuff like that, we can't remember to recognize the present moment. And so, you know, it ends up being a kind of a, you know, one step forward, 3 steps back. You know, you try and you notice how badly you're doing, mostly, initially. And so, you know, it's a kind of a steep curve to learn how to be, you know, aware, a little bit aware, a little bit continuous, a little bit of continuity to our awareness. So, actually, you know, this kind of practice that we're doing, this mindfulness for the development of insight, insight leading to understanding that liberates the mind, this is like the most refined and powerful teachings of the Buddha. But actually, we're only able to do that if we fill in all the preliminary practices underneath that to support it. So we're starting with, you know, like, we're starting at a postdoc program without having gone to high school. Difficult. You know, can you imagine doing a postdoc, you know, year? You know, after having got their high school, undergraduate, master's, doctorate, postdoc. So you start there, and if you haven't done your high school work, or your college work, your undergraduate work, it's like, it's frustrating. It's like, wow, impossible. It's just overwhelming. That's what we're trying. We're trying to do mindfulness for insight, postdoc work, without having done high school level, maybe grammar school. So tonight, I want to talk about the foundation. The foundation of our mind that we work with that supports our ability to develop mindfulness or insight and liberation. So to talk about what's called the three the three foundations of the Dharma. There are three foundations to develop in your own heart and mind to support the practice of all the practices of the Dharma, including mindfulness and insight. And sometimes they're called the three pillars of the Dharma, the three foundations of the Dharma, the three supports of the Dharma. And there are three because only two of them, you know, if you try to sit on a two-legged stool, it's kind of wobbly. You sit on a three-legged stool, and it's very steady. So the three-legged stool, which supports our Dharma aspirations. Now the Buddha's teachings of the Dharma and the practice of mindful awareness offers all the means necessary for a life of happiness, welfare, and a sense of well-being, both in this life and in future lives, if you happen to be in that, up to and including the liberation through awakening, however long that might take. And one of the qualities of the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, is it's not a matter of, it's not a belief system so much. It's not a faith-based system of practice, study, learning, knowledge. It's a, Buddha said something like, check it out for yourself. This is one of the qualities of the Dharma. It's like, check it out, you know, listen, practice, see for yourself. So it's really an empirical, experiential thing. If you practice, if you get your own experience, you have your own understanding of awareness and insight and liberation, then you know, this is how you do it. This is the value of it. You don't have to believe it, because I say so. And the Buddha even said, you know, he was speaking to some people, maybe something like you. He said, don't go by reports, don't go by legends, don't go by tradition, or scripture, or even logical conjecture, or inference, or by analogy, or by agreement through pondering on what somebody's saying, or by probability, or by the thought, oh, this teacher is that, this is that teacher. When you know for yourself, though, that these qualities of awareness, kindness, generosity, loving kindness, non-reactivity, energy, when you know that these qualities are skillful, that these qualities are blameless, that these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adapted and carried out, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should enter them, you should cultivate them, and you should use them in your life. But that's only if you know that for yourself. Just because I'm saying it, don't believe it. But listen, see if it makes sense, practice it yourself. If it works, then you know. If it doesn't work, forget it. Go somewhere else. But one of the central kind of foundational understandings to that really fits with our Western scientific logical mind, I hope you all trust science, the scientific method. You know, things happen due to causes and conditions, right? We're not into magic. I mean, magic happens because we don't understand the cause and conditions. But things happen due to causes and conditions. And our own happiness is just like that. It happens due to causes and conditions. It's not like you're born happy, or some people are born without a happiness gene or something like that. It doesn't work like that. It's like if you know the path to happiness, then you can cultivate those qualities of mind, the qualities in your heart. And you can't command it, you know. I mean, as my teacher now says, he says, the mind is not yours. Meaning, when that bone goes off, your mind is taken over by that bone. You didn't want the mind to be taken over by that bone. You didn't plan for it. You didn't think about it. You might not even like it. Nevertheless, your mind was taken over, right? Yeah. The mind is not yours. It's conditioned. But you're responsible for it. As soon as that phone goes off, you're responsible for your reaction. You know, judgment, irritation, frustration, humor, condemning the person. That's you're responsible for that mind. You can't prevent it being taken over, but you have to be responsible for how your mind. responds and reacts to everything in their life. So you read the news, right? You read the news every day. Why do you read the news every day? Does it make you feel really good? Does it make you feel good? That stuff. Well, if you're going around, moping around, kind of irritated and bothered by the way things are, well, how come? Causes a condition. You spend 3 hours reading the news. You didn't watch your own mind. You watched those minds. Okay, so this is this understanding of the lawful cause and effect relationship of experience called karma. Karma. It's like the law of gravity. You know, nobody invented the law of gravity. It's a law unto itself, isn't it? You know, you don't have to believe it. This guy Newton, he observed his daily experiences. He saw the apple fall from the tree, and he understood. Oh. And he kind of thought about it in a certain way, probably did some math, and he figured out that, hey, there's this force in the world called gravity. This is a naturally occurring thing. There is this law of gravity. You know, he didn't invent it. He just observed the way things are and articulated it in a way that everybody could kind of agree. Right? Okay, now, you don't have to believe what Newton said about the law of gravity. You don't have to agree with the law of gravity, but you'll suffer if you don't. Right? You know, if you don't think gravity's, you know, think, well, what the heck? I'm just going off the top of this building or whatever. No problem. No problem. So when you don't align your life with the laws of nature, you suffer. Okay? The physical laws of nature, the chemical laws of nature, the biological laws of nature, you know, everything is born, grows sick, grows old, dies. Everything. Nobody escapes that. That's the law of biology. Nobody invented that. Nobody can prevent it. That's just the way it is. Right? Well, there's this law of karma that says, you know, if you act with, you know, unskillful, harmful thoughts in your mind, you're going to have a really unpleasant experience. On the other hand, if you cultivate these wholesome qualities of mind, kindness, generosity, gratitude, love, you have a lot of patience, etc., your life is going to go. You don't have to believe it. Just check it out for yourself. Don't believe it just because I say so. Check it out for yourself. And if you see that that's the way it is, then have the courage to live up to what you actually observe and understand from your own experience. This is the way of Dharma. You hear it, you practice it, and you verify it for yourself. If you can't verify it yourself, then maybe it's not right for you. So, in our present life, the source of a tremendous amount of suffering for us is each other. Right? I mean, we get a lot of pleasure out of each other, too. So, no, don't think that. But, you know, when you look at the suffering in your life, where did it come from? The weather? Right? Other people? So, how are we going to kind of manage our life with that level of suffering? How are we going to learn to live in harmony with one another? How are we going to learn to kind of like accommodate the fact of life that we live in community? And I don't just mean Sacramento, I mean the world community. And I don't mean just mean humans, I mean humans and all the other creatures that we share with. Kind of mind you're going to have to accommodate this fact of life. Generosity, caring for one another, sharing what we have with one another, being responsive and responsible and caring for one another, kindness, compassion, love, and not hurting each other. Not doing and saying those things which really irritate yourself. Not killing either creatures or each other, not stealing, not taking what isn't yours, not acting out your sexual energy in a way that causes harm to you or others, either social harm, economic harm, physical harm, emotional harm. Jeez, it's in the news these days how much damage to careless. I mean, just careless. Right? Okay. And then speaking. You know, how much of our life is just spent speaking to each other. And, you know, we live in a culture that condones deception. Values deception. Rewards deception. Right? You know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I'm just saying, how can you live in this society and not be affected by that? Do you know how you're affected by that? Become cynical. Who trusts, who believes what people say? The politicians. Who believes that? Yeah. So we become cynical. We become shut up. We stop communicating. We stop trusting communication. I'm not telling you. I mean, you may be experiencing this already. I'm just pointing out what you're already aware of. And I'm saying, who's suffering when you experience cynicism and self and anger and rage? Who suffers? You do. You do. Other people have stolen your mind. You've lost your mind. So, what are you going to do to get your mind back? You have to pay attention. You have to pay attention to what is right speech in your life. What is the kind of speech that causes you to feel at ease and comfortable, connected, and appreciative of the person that you're listening to? But you have to learn to speak that way so you can recognize it in others. And when you don't hear from others, otherwise we just kind of think others the way it is. People just talk like this. And it's okay. It's not okay because you suffer. So this learning to live in harmony, learning to live with some kind of ease, contentment, trust, a sense of communion with one another, is because we can watch our own mind. We can cultivate these skills that conduce to harmony inside with yourself and harmony outside. In Buddhist languages, this is through the practice of sila or morality and the practice of generosity or dana. These two qualities, these two activities of being generous with your time, with your knowledge, with your love, with your respect, with your appreciation, really important in our human community to cultivate, to recognize that. Because it honors our humanity to offer respect to one another and to acknowledge the interdependence. We can't get along with it. We rely on everybody else doing their job in order to be able to do our job and be able to live here. So this kind of practice establishes a foundation of tolerance that is conducive to peacefulness and a sense of well-being and harmony in our life. So without that, even without that little bit, you sit down to watch your mind, I'm trying to be mindful. Excuse me, it's a freaking mess in there. what really amazed me is, this Bodhisattva guy in that way. He sits down, he looks at his mind, not much different than ours, and he figures it out. He goes, wow, this is what's going on here, this is what I got to do to fix it, so to speak, this is what I got to do to kind of free myself from this kind of suffering, free myself from cynicism, criticism, anger, irritation, frustration, disappointment, depression. So this goes on and on and on. When you look at your mind, can you figure it out? That's like, it's impossible. Right? Okay. A couple years ago, I was working with a group in a large city on the West Coast, and I go to this city half a dozen times a year, spend a day with them, senior students of mine, and I would stay in a hotel in town, and spend a day with them. I always lived in the country, ranch land, farm land, far away from congested areas. So I'm not at that time, I was not familiar with homeless people. I know there's homeless people, I hear about it, you know, I see occasionally. But boy, in this city, next to the hotel, every street, there were homeless people. Panhandlers and beggars and people living on the street. It was really kind of, well, shocking. So I come out of the hotel to go get breakfast, and geez, I was looking. I try to find the street that there weren't homeless people, because they didn't kind of understand what was going on there. And I tried to avoid them, but I couldn't avoid them. They were everywhere. So after a couple of times going to the city, and I saw all these homeless people, and I tried to avoid them, go out the back door, and go down the side alleys. I started to notice that I was suffering. I was afraid. I was afraid of them. I got anxious. I didn't know what was expected of me. I didn't know how to understand it. I felt like, I don't know. I mean, you know what it's like? You know, but sometimes, I mean, maybe you're used to, you know, homeless people. I wasn't. So I said, wow, boy, this is really, my mindfulness, my ability to recognize the present moment's experience, said, I'm feeling fear, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling confused, I'm feeling like avoiding these people. I want to avoid this fact of life because I don't feel comfortable. And I said, now wait a minute, I'm suffering. Who is going to do anything about my suffering? You know, it's not like anybody's going to get all those people off the street or pick them up or kind of give them a job. Or, no. But only I can do something about my suffering. Right? Only I can do it. So I said, I'm suffering. I've got to do something about this. So I said, well, the thing to do is I'm going to have to greet them and meet them. So I come out of the hotel and I go right up to them and I say, you know, get down where they are. How's it going? How are you doing today? Did you have a warm place to sleep last night? Where did you sleep last night? Yeah. What do you need today? Well, how much money? You know, they always go inside and need some money. What do you need the money for today? Oh, we want to get a bus ticket somewhere. Or you need to do your laundry. You need to get a fix. Whatever. Okay. And I would talk to them. And you know what I realized? They're human. They're human just like you and I. And they just have some unfortunate situation in their life. Well, for whatever reason, they've got the funds, maybe they got a little, you know, maybe they're sick, maybe they got some trauma, maybe they got a drug addiction as a way of coping with the pain of life. Because they're all human. And they're just like you and I. And I would talk to them and, you know, just kind of ask about their life, make a connection with them. You know, I would offer some token of support, $1, $2, maybe $5, depending on who they were, how much they needed, what it was for. And I would go down the street to the next one. You know, it didn't take long before I realized it made me really happy. I really got happy to connect with them, to really begin to understand them. Not because I could solve their problem, I couldn't solve their problem, I couldn't give enough money to solve the problem, I couldn't take them home with me to give them. Do their laundry or anything like that, but I could recognize their humanity. And every time that we connect with someone like that, or anyone in need, and you make a gesture of connecting with them and maybe offering them some support, in this case, cash, what you really give every time is love. That's what you give. It might be $1, it might be $2, it might be whatever. It might be just give a little time. Just give up. You get connection. And this does your heart well. Because it gives you this connection. It kind of acknowledges your humanity. To do that, you have to have a sense of self-reliance and a sense of abundance in your life. Like, I have the time, I have the care, I have some money, I have enough. I have enough to share with somebody. And so, Mahasi Sayadaw, as mentioned, the book that we translated, he said, it is generosity you can rely on for your humanity your wealth, and your happiness.
True.
Practicing generosity. You can't be generous if you don't know that you have enough, and that you have an abundance of wealth. It might be knowledge, it might be time, it might be energy, it might be money. Listen, everybody in this room, you know, as bad as it might be for you, I don't know your situation. You might be almost homeless, well, I don't know. You might be poor, I don't know. Might be, whatever. We are in the top 1% of 1% of all the humans that ever lived on this earth. We have got everything. More than you need. I hope you're right. We are in the top 1%. Even more than that. Less than 1%. We're up there. We are. This is it. Are we happy yet? Are we content yet? Do we have enough yet? Mm-hmm. And why not? Well, we're not paying attention. So when we pay attention, you know, we see that we live and we can share and we can care and we can respect and we can connect and we can honor happiness. This is the foundation for this thing we're trying to do with the Dharma Silent City. Watch your mind and feel at ease with it. No, we can't because our mind is really not comfortable with it. Because we have all these reactions, we have all this anxiety, frustration, disappointment, fear, stuff like that. Well, you got to do something about that. In fact, you can't do something about your fear and anxiety and your, you know, depression and your, but, you know, you're not going to get the government to do it. You're not going to get your partner to do it for you. You're going to have to do it. This is a do-it-yourself job. That's what the Buddha said. Check it out for yourself. You should be, if you find out that this is the right way to go, then you should cultivate it. Take the courage, have the courage to live with what you know to be true. But we practice awareness so that we can see, so we can really understand for ourselves what causes us to suffer, what causes us to stop suffering. So when we practice generosity, when we practice sila, or living in harmony with one another, not killing, not stealing, not acting out sexually in a way that causes harm, speaking the truth, and avoiding intoxicants. Hey, you know when you read the newspaper, you know, you get up in the morning, you read the newspaper, I guess nobody reads newspapers. You go to your news aggregator, what is it? It's a catalog of people misbehaving on the face of the earth yesterday. They cause a whole bunch of other people to suffer. What is it? A daily catalog of tormenting one another. Right? What a way to start your day. Happy day, come on. And yes, it's good to know. You know, you can look, you can, I mean, I did this one time. I did a New York Times. I didn't take this a little bit, but I took a big one. I went through and I marked every article. This is an example of greed, this is an example of killing, this is an example of fear, this is an example of deceit, this is an example of... That's news. But there's a whole lot going on in your life that's not that kind of news. What are you grateful for? Who are you connected with? How do you love? Okay, so as great as all the merit of practicing generosity and taking refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha and practicing sila is, as great, the Buddha said, as great as all this goodness is, all the development of that, it would be even more beneficial if you would develop a loving heart, even for the time it takes to pull a cow's out. Well, let's use a modern thing. You know, even if you develop loving kindness, even for the time it takes you to check your email. Right? And as great as all that would be, it would be even more fruitful if you would develop the perception of impermanence just for the time it takes to snap your finger. All the benefit of generosity. all the benefit of loving kindness, all the benefit of non-harming through keeping the precepts, and all the loving kindness you could possibly imagine, it would be better if you could perceive impermanence. That's why we practice insight. Think about that. What is so important about understanding, realizing deeply for yourself, impermanence? How can you take yourself so seriously? Really? You are just a blip on the face of this earth in all eternity. Gone. That understanding changes your focus, your view of everything else that's going on in your life. If you really deeply get it, if you really deeply see, this is the way it is. Then it only makes sense to help others understand that, to ease their burdens, to kind of address their suffering, because you see something. And so when we help, when we support others and care for them, you have some understanding of their suffering. They may not know it yet. So these practices of generosity, loving kindness, living ethically, so not to harm one another, Buddha said, do not fear these meritorious actions. This is an expression denoting happiness. This is what is desirable, what is wished for, what is dear, what is agreeable. That is these wholesome activities of mind. For he said, I know full well that for a long time I experienced the desirable, the wished for, the dear, the agreeable result of having been generous, kind, loving, patient, not harmful. For the long lifetime, actually enjoyed the benefits. So the first foundation of the Dharma, established in the Dharma life, is generosity. Dana, call it. It's a mindless practice, like me walking down the street. You know, if you're not paying attention to the present moment, you're not going to notice that you're suffering. You're not going to notice that there's an opportunity to help support someone, stop something. But even that, the Buddha said, that's good. It's good to help others. But to practice generosity, not only to help other people that are in need, but because it adorns our own mind. It embellishes our own mind with this quality of non-attachment. Letting go. When you practice generosity, you learn to let go. You let go of, well, the thing you give. You let go of your pride. You let go of your arrogance. You let go of your sense of, well, you let go of attachment itself. It's a compassionate action. We practice generosity because we see suffering. And when, as I said, like when I was at home with people, every time we practice generosity, we're saying to this person in so many words, I see you. I care about you. That's what we're saying. Every time. And this generosity, this is the fundamental virtue of the spiritual life, because it the first practice we can take on that kind of gets us out of our egocentric, self-acquiring focus of our mind. We start to connect with other people in a kind of a not a self-centric. What can you do for me? What can I get out of you? But from a wow, there's two of us here. Okay, let's do something together. Rather than it's all about me and mine, getting and having and keeping at your expense if necessary. So there's one of our students, she lives in the Bay Area, and she's been a student for a couple of decades. She has this audacity. She started this nonprofit called Enough. Enough. And her challenge and her the focus of this nonprofit is to take into corporate boardrooms the question, what is enough? And the corollary is that is, how are you going to recognize it? Think about that. You look in your own closet lately? Has anybody got any room in their closet? Nobody's got room in their closet. In fact, we've got storage bins holding stuff that we can't see it all at once. Got a knot? Yes. What's a knot? Not just a quality of mind, really. It's not a lot of stuff. It's a quality of heart, isn't it? You know. But nobody is going to sell you the idea of a knot. Right? There's no advertiser out there saying, you don't need this product. It's really reliable, but you don't need it. Nobody's selling a knot. The Dharma sells a knot. The Dharma says, hey, look, you have a knot. We live in this world, and I mentioned the topic. It's debatable to some people, and not debatable to me. Maybe it is to you. I'm sorry if it is. But you know, we're living on this earth, and it's in trouble. It's in trouble because we have not recognized that we have enough. Right? And we're consuming more than the earth can not just supply, but more than the earth can live with. Okay. You know, for myself, I'm 69. I'm going to get off this planet before it burns up, before the water rises too much higher, and before my property at 2,000 feet is shoreline property, which, you know, the glaciers or whatever it is. I'm going to get off this earth. I might be back. Teenagers. They are so optimistic about life. They are just, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16. They're just like, do you remember what you were like then? Like, life? Like, wow. Man. You got to root away from something. They do. The world is going to be a different place than what it was when we grew up. But I'd like to leave it a better place. I'd like to leave it a place that our children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, grandnieces, grandnephews, that they can enjoy living and have their own sense of abundance and health. That they can be a healthy place. But it's not going to happen, magically. It happens to causes giving rise to that effect. So each one of us has to look inside our own heart and say, what is it we have to do? Yeah. Some of it's changed our thinking, some of it's changed our patterns of consumption, some of it's organizing. But there are untold generations of beings yet to be born who are going to want the same opportunities that we have. Think about that. There are these two kinds of persons that are rare in the world, Buddha said. One who takes initiative in helping others, and one who's grateful. Grateful. You know that in the Western psychological experiments in literature, the single most effective intervention for engendering a sense of well-being is expressing your gratitude. Doesn't even cost you anything. Just think about what you're grateful for and tell somebody. And especially if you're grateful for someone, go to them and tell them. You will feel better. You will have a sense of well-being. Don't think about it for it. Just gonna say this and then it gave you a good, you know, a teacher among teachers.
That's great.
But don't take my word for it. You have to find out for yourself. Because actually, when you hear something that I say, or when you read something that other teachers have written, it only goes in this far into your mind. Only this far. But if you try it for yourself, it goes in this far. And if you begin to see the result, it'll get deeper and deeper. And it really then take over your heart. And then you'll know for sure this is the only way to live. This is an idea, it doesn't get in. But if you actually do it as a practice, then it gets in. And then you can know for sure. When we practice the Dharma, when we practice the Buddha's teaching, when we learn to wake up, when we practice generosity and non-harming and loving kindness and all of the whole litany of practices that the Buddha offers, says the Dharma protects those who protect the Dharma. If you protect the Dharma in your life, the way things are, the Dharma is the way things are, the Dharma is the truth, it's the way things are for you. If you recognize that and you take care of it, you protect it, you value it, then the truth will protect you. Or is it in another condition that says the truth will set you free? Yeah? What that means? Truth. It means if you know the truth of your heart, you'll be free. It's not out there, it's in here. It also says that the gift of the Dharma excels all other forms of giving. Meaning we can give money, we can give love, we can give, but the gift of the Dharma excels all other forms of giving. Now what does that mean? I mean I'm talking about the Dharma, I'm giving you the Dharma there. Yeah, no, that's not what it means. It means if you listen to the Dharma, if you practice the Dharma, your life is going to be a living expression of the way things are in the Dharma. You become a walking, talking Dharma, fountain of the way things are. Able to see, well, this is the way it is in here, out there. This is the way it is in our relationship. This is the way it is being a teacher and being a student. This is the way it is. When you know that, and you move into your life with that knowledge of, oh, this is the way it is in my heart. This is the way it is in my relationship with you. This is what matters. This is what I care about. This is what I'm grateful for. When you start living from the place of knowing yourself, knowing the truth of yourself, then you give a gift to everyone that you share life with. Even just practicing seal, practicing the precepts, non-harming, for killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, speaking the truth, and not misusing it. If you can actually live like that for even a little bit, what are you doing? You're giving a gift to everyone that you share life with, that you're not going to harm them, you're not going to oppress them, you're not going to deceive them, you're not going to make unreasonable demands on them. It's a gift. It's a gift that you give everyone that you share life with. And if you don't practice sila, you give them something else. A cause for worry, anxiety, caution, apprehension, fitness, fear. You create our own. So the first of the foundations is we're going to be over now. 15 minutes. I'm going to start it. Well, I told my dear Indra, he was an Indian fellow that was the campaign of peace and taught a lot of us back in the beginning days. He says, you know, when you'd ask him a question about the Dharma, he would just start talking. He would never stop. Because it says, if you pull one thread of the Dharma, it's connected to everything else. I wasn't there at the time, but I've heard that he once gave a talk that went on for more than 8 hours, and he didn't stop until everybody had left. The last time he came to Willie Kamal and I on Maui, question from the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, that kind of bugged me. And so when he came, you know, well, the second day, I said, "No, Mitra, I got a question. I want to ask you about something." You know? And so yeah, I asked him, and he started talking. And every opportunity he had for the rest of the next three or four days that he was there, he kept going back to that question, kind of filling me in a little more, but it never would end. So everything in your life is connected to everything else in your life. If you put the Dharma in there, then the Dharma will infect your whole life. Or I should say, it will inoculate. Stuff here. I have to record it.
There's one thing I got to read here. Bodhicitta.
So I'm talking about happiness, right? You know, I'm trying to learn to live in harmony with one another, having care, consideration, respect for one another. So Lama Yeshe was a great Tibetan Lama last century. Very down to earth, taught a lot of Westerners. He said, talking about bodhicitta. You know, bodhicitta is the mind that wants to awaken, waking mind. He said, if you want to be really happy, if you want to be really happy, it isn't enough to just space out in meditation. Many people who spent years alone in meditation have finished up the worst for it. Coming back to society, get freaked out. They haven't been able to take contact with other people again. All the difficulties in our interpersonal relationships comes from not having loving kindness, the essence of the attitude of the bodhisattva, which creates space in the mind. Your human relationships are not for chocolate, not for sensory pleasures only. Something much deeper can come from our being together, from our working together. And then, the more you are involved, the more you are involved with people, the more pleasure you get. People become the resource for your pleasure. Then you're living for them. And no matter where you go, you'll never freak out. You just be practical. If you can't help others, at least don't bother them. Stay neutral. Okay, one last thing. I plant trees. Now, as Dennis was mentioning, we've got the 17 acres there, small sanctuary. And I always wanted to have a cottage in the forest. Of course, there was no forest there when we were talking about the land. So, as Dennis said, cleared the land, planted some trees. That was the first batch, 340. 354 koa trees, but you know, I made a mistake. Those koa seeds came from 6,000 foot elevation where they get a lot of water. I'm at 2,000 foot elevation, we only get 25 inches of water a year. So, no matter how much I irrigate them, I'm very enthusiastic. I have a lot of energy. I'm stupid. Don't practice like that. You need to learn, huh? You need to get some education. Now I planted another 2,500 trees, fruit trees and orchard trees and shade trees and 5 acres of humber and mahogany and sandalwood trees. Now sandalwood trees, they take 400 or 500 years to mature. We're not going to be harvesting them. So the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva was born under a tree. He sat under a tree. He first attained jhana, or deep absorption, concentrated mind, under a tree. And he realized his full awakening to become a Buddha under a tree. And when he died under a tree. And he said, "I resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest." And one of the noble ones, possessed of wisdom, seeing in myself this possession of wisdom, I found great solace in dwelling in the forest. It is because I see two benefits that I still resort to
to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest. I see a pleasant abiding for myself here and now, and I have compassion for future generations. There are these trees and the roots of trees. There are empty huts. Meditate. Do not be negligent, lest you regret it. I said that. But that's what the Buddha said. But then there's something of a koan thing. The Buddha resorts to the forest because of what gives him a pleasant abiding here and now. And the second reason is he has compassion for future generations. How does him going to the forest express compassion for future generations? This is a Vipassana koan. If it's obvious to anybody, please fill me in. I mean, I've been thinking about this about a year now. Kind of like got my thoughts, but it's a rich vein of so kind of. But I always like to give people questions because I say a lot of things that kind of might not be believable, let alone something they're interested in. So yeah.
More than enough. And so I have more than enough capacity to do good. And I have more than enough greed to want to go after more than enough. And so what brings me to this question is, how can I steer clear of having more than enough of either greed or capacity to do good? I find that in doing good, I want to be recognized. And then that takes me down that slippery slope. I want to be appreciated. And that's never enough. So, in the practice, what would you suggest, based on your experience, to be able to accept that there is going to be more than enough on either side? And how do I manage it? How do I steer clear? I like how it feels when I'm doing good. Not just staying out of the way and doing no harm, but actually going towards doing good. I like how that feels. And so, how am I, this person, steer clear from either the high, low, and swings?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. Partly because you articulated it really well. You know, you're right in the middle. You know, if you go this way, you do good, but you get hooked into pride and inflation and kind of self-aggrandizing, you know, that way. And if you don't do it, then you feel kind of miserable too. There's nothing wrong with feeling good, except excitement, feeling good, undermines awareness. Okay? So when you're feeling good, don't lose your will. Really. Stay there, stay with that feeling. Stay aware of that feeling. So that you're not just indulging in it and inflating yourself with iron eye or something. You know, that's going to come. But you'll see that leads to suffering. That leads to a sense of, you know, deflation when you're not getting that recognition. So it's like, oh, okay. So let me not get inflated. Let me do good. Let me feel good. But I'm not gonna hold on to that as this is who I really am. I'm this generous, kind, loving person. See me? Mm-hmm. No, and some people are not going to see you at all. Mm-hmm. No longer. So, see, understand what.
what you're experiencing and why you're experiencing it, but don't hang on to it. You're feeling good?
Great.
Don't hang on. You're feeling like you're abundant, you can abundance you can share?
Great.
You know, keep it away.
Great.
Don't hold on to that idea. Even that idea about yourself as being a good person or being, well, kind of still not having enough. Either one of them. You're not either one. You're not the person that doesn't have enough. You're not the person that got so much that can give it all away. You're either one. Those are states of mind that arise, and when you see them, good. If you don't see them, you'll get caught in them and you'll believe that's who I am. That's where you suffer. We often experience all of those things our whole life. But it's when we get identified with them, yes, this is who I am. When we take a momentary experience of joy or a momentary experience of I don't have enough, whatever it is, when we take a momentary experience and eternalize it into, oh, this is the way it's always going to be, or this is the way I always am, then, you know, we take a momentary experience, we eternalize it to I'm always this way. And as soon as we get that kind of mistaken belief, then it's just a slippery slope to I'm a needy person. I'm a greedy person. I'm a generous person. And once you get that idea in your mind of I am this way, you really don't suffer. Not that way. Sometimes you experience that, sometimes you don't. But if you get this identity to hold on to, that's what you suffer, isn't it? Whether it's even an inflated sense of self or a deflated sense of self. So, the antidote for the question you asked, the answer to the question you asked is stay mindfully aware of each of those experiences when they arise for as long as they're present. You'll see that they come due to causes and conditions. You experience them. When those causes and conditions come to an end, you don't experience that anymore. Don't long for it. Don't look for it. There'll be no experience happening right now. So we want to be careful about eternalizing momentary experiences and getting identified with it.
Yeah. The flip side of that, talk about the impermanence.
Yeah.
And when we recognize that we are so small, we don't have that.
Wait. I did say, don't fall. I didn't say we don't matter. I'm saying we're a speck in the universe in all eternity. But I'm not saying we don't matter.
I think maybe that's the question. How do we not come to that conclusion?
Go outside, find the first homeless person you can, and see if there's anything you could possibly do to help make their life better. Then you matter, right? Then you matter. It's not necessary. This is not a philosophical theory. This is like a practical, try it out for yourself. You have some resources, you have some knowledge, you have some time. If you can help one person suffer less, he matters. It doesn't have to be money. As they say, carry socks in your car. Socks. Most of the people need warm socks. Every time you come to a stop sign and there's a homeless person there, go down your window and give them a pair of socks. That's what they need more, as much as anything. I know. I did some research. Other comments? Questions? Okay, so on Saturday, we're going to have this day long here for 95 or something like that. And we're going to be practicing awareness. I'll be offering instructions like I did at sitting. And we'll sit for a while, have an instruction, and you'll have an experience. At the end of that, we're going to talk about what was your experience, how did it go, what did you notice, and then I can offer you some understanding and some teaching. We'll have some periods of standing, walking, getting drinks, going to the toilet, stuff like that. It's kind of like milling about mindfully.
cocktail party, that would help them. Or coffee. So you don't lose your mind. And then we'll sit again. And I'll give you a little more advanced instruction. And we'll have some experience. We'll talk about that. And that's where we're going to go all day.
Boring.
Not boring. Anyway, I invite you, if you haven't signed up, I invite you to consider coming. It'll be worth the wait. So, are we done? 9:15?
Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you very much.